Good evening. Can everyone hear me? Good. Welcome to the Society Library. I'm Carol Malone, a library trustee. We're pleased to be able to offer an ongoing series of diverse events with authors, scholars, and performers. And for a list of our upcoming events, I hope you'll pick up a list of our events in the spring newsletter at the door. As we begin, may I ask everybody to silence their cell phones and anything else that makes noise. I also remind you that the Society Library thrives and prospers through the generosity of its donors. For more information, please speak to me afterwards or to our development staff or see our website. We are so delighted this evening to have with us two of our library authors, Elizabeth Strout and Meg Wolitzer. Ms. Strout's novel, Olive Kittredge, won the 2009 Pulitzer Prize, was nominated for the National Book Critics Circle Award, and was a New York Times bestseller. She is also the author of Abide With Me and Amy and Isabel, both bestsellers. Meg Wolitzer's current novel, The Uncoupling, is The Uncoupling, and her other acclaimed books include The 10-Year Nap, The Position, The Wife, and Surrender, Dorothy. We have The Uncoupling and Olive Kittredge for sale in the lobby, and the authors will be happy to sign copies after the event. Please join me in welcoming Elizabeth Strout and Meg Wolitzer.
Yeah, mine is not going on. Yeah, I don't have a red light on mine. Does that matter? Oh, it's working.
Are you going to talk louder? Okay. Can you hear us?
No? I think our mics are not. Okay. It's not. Really? There's no red light on mine. Really? This is such a great way to begin. All right. Well, boom.
All right. I'll just yell, I guess. I thought that I would start by just very briefly telling you what my definition of character is so that we have a sense of what I'm talking about, because Meg will probably and hopefully be talking about something different. My sense of character is actually nothing that can really be defined, but when I talk about character, which I love, when I talk about character, I'm talking about something that goes below personality traits. It goes all the way down to the roots of what causes us to do whatever we do. As far as I'm concerned, it's always mysterious, which is one reason that I am a writer and someone so interested in that mystery. But the important part that I want to get across to you right now is that I consider character to be something that's intuitive. As a writer, I use my intuition to sort of discover that character, to go down inside that character. There's no rules that I operate with except my intuition about what's real, what's within the character, what's reasonably within that character, what's surprising in that character. And what I'm hoping to do is to provide the reader with the same sense of an intuitive experience. So that's my sense of character, is to present something believable enough and intuitive enough that the reader joins that experience without consciously even knowing it.
I think I don't disagree with any of that. So there's no smackdown happening tonight here. But we sort of set the task for ourselves of trying to define what it is. And it's interesting because if some of you are writers here, I imagine, yeah. The whole room nods as one. You know how you don't think of these things necessarily discreetly, but when you're asked to do so for an evening like this, although we came up with the subject, and maybe we did because we wanted to kind of grapple with what it is we've been doing intuitively, and what is it actually that we have been doing. And I started thinking that I realized recently I made a phone call. I wanted to make a phone call to a friend. I'd been working all day, and my reward was I was going to make a call to a friend. but who would I call? And I started thinking of a particular person I wanted to call. And it wasn't that she needed to hear what was going on with me or I needed to hear what was going on with her, but there was some quality that I got from her that I hadn't really named. And I guess it's her essence. And maybe in a weird way, when you create a character, you're looking for that kind of thing, that sort of essence. And it's not necessarily that you go to books for knowledge, but I thought maybe you go for proximity. Proximity to character, proximity to the sensibility of the writer. So it's this particular essence that feels right for the story. And we may not be able to name it exactly, but we crave it, and we create this kind of primordial soup. And out of it comes a few traits, a few qualities, a passion for table tennis or a distinctive laugh. But it's this sort of tumbleweed. Look, tumbleweed and primordial soup in the same sentence. Mixing metaphors. But they gather things. But it starts with a desire for a particular thing. When you call, if you're a writer, when you call a friend, ask yourself, what is it that you get from that friend that you can't name? And maybe you'll be able to sort of see what his or her essence is and maybe apply it in a weird way when you're writing. So I know that everybody throws around the E.M. Forster great phrase, only connect, really, the maxim. But it seems to me particularly durable because we live in this nonfiction era. And sometimes to me, fiction seems like a luxury item or sort of like a rarefied thing like chamber opera. But what novels do, and I think what characters in a novel do, is keep themselves very, very close. And they make us look at them. And we become like the person on the other end of the phone, but it's not a friendship. And the writer, I guess, in developing character is part psychoanalyst, doing what Freud said, which is to use an evenly hovering attention. But in my family, there are a lot of therapists, and there are also dermatologists. And I think a writer is somewhat like the dermatologist who does the yearly full body exam in which everything's exposed, and there's a big white light on you or on the character. And they're looking for things, the writer, and they find them, and they continue to look, and maybe they're dispassionate about them. And what's found, I think, are those moments in life that could be difficult or could be joyful, but in fiction, I think that they're always the ones that are most concentrated. And everything in a novel and everything in a character, maybe, is just highly concentrated, and those are the things that we need in order to stay very close. So I think closeness, proximity, is my entry into this. So.
Okay, so Megan and I are going to ask each other a couple questions, kind of like have a conversation here about parenting and what we promised you. So my first question, because I've actually often wondered it about Meg, is if she generally starts the book with an idea or with a character. Because I think those are two very different ways of beginning a book.
You know, I used to actually start books with characters. It was the way, I think when you learn to write, it may be the way that you go inside something. And if you think actually about the great novels, what you remember about them, almost to a one, is not plot, but character. But I began novels with character. When I was very, very young and starting to write, I wanted to write about any experience that I knew nothing about, a blind child, or a girl growing up in Vietnam. Those were the ones I really wanted to write about. Or even to understand male experience or the adult experience. I remember I wrote a short story when I was like in second grade that my mother saved. It was about two truckers. And the dialogue went, come on up on the rig, Mac. I didn't know what a rig was, but I was using the cadences of adult life. But then as I got in recent years, I noticed something, or maybe a friend pointed it out, when I called her, which was that in recent years, my novels have all begun with the word the, since I wrote a novel called The Wife. And ever since then, they've been very idea-driven in a way. And I hadn't done this consciously, but for me now, I do enter through an idea. What if your husband were this big bloated novelist? What if there were a spell that ended sex? I mean, and the characters came about through the soup of the idea. So I guess these days, it's through idea. Well, I will ask you, unless you have any questions about that.
But. No, I'll just respond. You didn't ask me, but I'll just say. I don't really have ideas. So I think it's interesting that we're different that way.
What do you mean you don't have ideas?
No, I don't have ideas. I don't, actually. I start...
This friendship is over.
It may be. But I doubt it. But I just think it's interesting for you to hear how different it is for people to approach the page. And I truly don't have ideas. I see people. I'm interested in that. So I think that's an interesting difference. That's all.
Well, can you tell us then on a kind of almost cellular level how Olive Kitteridge came about? Which is not exactly where do you get your ideas, but like, can you track it?
Yeah.
Great.
I saw her. I saw her. I saw a picnic table. The very first Olive Kitteridge story I wrote was, at least in my knowledge, I could be totally making this up. I'm sure you all understand. But in my memory of this, the first complete Olive Kitteridge story I wrote was the one where she is overhearing her new daughter-in-law at the wedding, at her son's wedding. And surprisingly for me, I actually saw the beginning of that story because I never write in order, but I actually did see the first scene, and what I saw was a picnic table with this large woman standing next to the picnic table. I have no idea why. I don't know anybody who has a picnic table. The last time I remember a picnic table in my life was you know, many, many years ago as a child, and it was not that same scene. So it just rose up, this picnic table, and this large woman, and she was thinking to herself, you know, it's high time everybody goes home. And I thought, yeah, it is. And that's how I started.
That's so interesting, because that's so different.
Yeah, it's different. Well, that's what I'm trying to say, is that you get to see both things.
But I'm thinking about that picnic table now, and I still think it has a locus. You know, it has something. We may never know it, right? Like what happened in the moments before the Big Bang. We may never know it exactly, but I wonder what, you know, what did you cathect to, if you will, in maybe the picnic table in your childhood that you didn't even know? Maybe nothing.
I don't know, and
I don't care.
I'm not particularly interested.
Yeah, because it won't.
Because I just went straight for this woman.
Yeah.
She was so compelling because she was big and she was thinking, you know, she just like had it with being nice.
Right.
Not that she'd done much of being nice.
Yeah, right.
But she'd been listening to everybody be nice, and I just felt it. I just felt it, you know, with her, that sense of like, okay, I'm kind of done here.
Well, that leads me to ask you this. Flannery O'Connor gave quite a few talks about writing, and do you know this collection, Mystery and Manners, which is really her wonderful essays and talks? And one of them, she speaks about writing stories, and she refers to her story, Good Country People, which is about the girl with the brilliant, angry daughter with the wooden leg that gets stolen away by a Bible salesman at the end. And people always asked Flannery O'Connor when she gave talks about the symbolism of the wooden leg. And she said something to the effect of that before it became a symbol, it had to be a leg. And I thought that was so wonderful and so true of writing, and it made me think about a character who's so outstanding, who's so memorable, like Olive. Is she representative? Is she symbolic to you, or is she just herself?
She's not symbolic to me. She's Olive to me. She may very well, and I suspect in some way, you know, I don't know, actually. I can't. I can only say what she is to me.
Maybe she's all of us.
Well, there's probably a little more Olive than people want to know about themselves.
Sorry.
But that's your issue. I mean, I think Flannery O'Connor, you know, I think she's amazing. And I can't say that my characters are represented. Like I said, I don't have ideas. And that would require an idea.
Right.
But Flannery O'Connor was also the person who said character is destiny, which I found intriguing in my youth. And then I began to think more that, well, biology is destiny, and time and place in history is destiny. And so I sort of, you know, stopped dwelling on it quite as much. but it's my turn now to ask you
yes.
a question. So, like, because you wrote, you know, I don't write in the first person anymore since, you know, for okay. years I haven't, and because you wrote a whole novel in the first person with this character, you know, it's really interesting to me, like, what's the difference in the yeah. actual sitting down and coming to that page every day when the narration is first person as opposed to third person and the development of that character?
It is so, so different. And I'll tell you a little bit. The one novel that I wrote in first person is this book called The Wife. And actually, I came about it in a sort of weird way. I don't even think I've told you this. I had a book under contract that I'd written a little bit of. It was under contract based on the idea of it, really, more than anything else, which was that I was going to write a novel based on Freud's patient, Dora. And I even made the big trip to Vienna, and I had the schnitzel and did the whole thing. And I started writing it, and I was very excited at the beginning because I wanted to write from her point of view, in her voice. Because Freud, there's a great line from Janet Malcolm about how Freud conducted that analysis like she was a patient without anesthesia, some line like that. And I thought, well, if the patient gets to speak, what would she say? And for a while, it was kind of a neat parlor trick. But I became very hampered by the constraints of the cadences and language that I could use from that period in time, you know, end of that century. And it was like, oh my God, how can I write a whole novel in a corset, is really how I felt. And I didn't want to. So, but I was enjoying the idea of writing in first person. The thing with first person, I guess how you know, if some of you maybe set something in first person, then shift it, try to do it in third person, and don't really know which, if the voice is really kind of outsized in some way, I think first person may be a way to go. And I realized that I wanted to kind of break out of the voice of Dora, who couldn't, it's not like she was suddenly getting her chance, let me tell you what that Freud did to me. It wasn't going to be like that. But when I wrote this character, Joan Castleman, in The Wife, she was very angry and she was very funny. And rather than keep a distance that third person can sometimes do, the kind of distance of lyricism, I wanted to see what would happen if I did it in first person. And I found it highly enjoyable because I more directly inhabited that voice than I generally do. So it was more rollicking in a funny way. So, and you would never think about?
Oh, first person, you know, it just doesn't work for me. It takes away that fiction that I'm not really writing about myself. So I think it's stuck with the third person.
It is weird, I want to say, how we feel. I feel protected by this armor as a fiction writer. Like, I feel like all my nonfiction writer friends have to answer to how much of that is autobiographical, and I feel like a child who thinks nobody can see them because they're covered with a blanket, their face, but in fact everyone can see me, you know?
Yeah.
So, I'm in trouble now.
Well, I can. I mean, I've always told my students, you know, writing, there's nothing, I mean, you can... A laundry list reveals yourself. A grocery list reveals yourself. You cannot write without revealing yourself. And you certainly can't write worth anything that's worth reading without revealing yourself.
Yeah.
So in order to fool, at least speaking for myself, in order to fool myself, you know, I think, well, I'm actually writing about this person or that person. And, you know, I've never been this, that, or the other thing.
Well, you know, actually in the Dora case, Freud said something like, and even if the mouth doesn't reveal itself, the hands will. That you know, that things would, right, things would get out. But tell me, actually, in terms of not yourself or yourself, can you talk a little bit about writing about men? Because Tyler Caskey, in Liz's equally brilliant novel, Abide With Me, is male, and you do such a stirring job with him. What was that like? Do you feel... do you tread more cautiously when you write about men, or no?
Well, first of all, I want to say that this friendship is just fine. You've always been wonderful about Abide With Me, which is very touching to me. It's my middle book about a male, good character. And I remember when it came out, and that's when we actually started to become friends. The fact of the matter is that I don't actually find it any more difficult to write about a man than a woman, and I've often wondered about. No, actually, that's not true. I haven't often wondered about it. People have often wondered about it for me, and so then I've wondered about it and sort of felt like I should wonder about it more. The problem with writing about Tyler Caskey was that he was a person who essentially really wanted to be a good person. And that's very difficult to write about because, you know, drama is just, you're always trying to scrape against the grain of the floor to find the drama. And, you know, here's this big man. He's a minister and he wants to be good. Now, where's, you know? So that was hard.
Right.
But I don't have a sense. It's like the character is either male or female, and
you're an equal opportunity
employer. I am an equal opportunity provider.
Yeah. Okay, good.
Well. Yeah.
So are you out of questions?
No, I have another question.
Okay.
What kind of relationship, if any, do you hope that your readers have with your characters as opposed to your narrative voice or as opposed to the idea of the book? But what kind of relationship do you hope your readers have with the characters?
When I'm writing, I never think about my readers. They are...
Okay. I thought you were going to say character. I mean...
Oh.
No. Okay. All right. Okay.
No, I don't. The reader is like a blurry-faced me, I guess. And my relationship, I imagine. I mean, you have to kind of be Candide when you're writing, in a way, or at least I do. You have this hopefulness that it will all work out okay. At least, again, I'm only speaking for myself, and you know, because you have no ideas apparently that
I don't.
Not true. I don't.
I just have great deal. Uncomfortable.
No, I have this hopeful sense that the reader, I guess, when I'm kind of nearing the end, the reader is almost like me. I don't think I'm so freakish that the readers can't relate to the kind of things that I think about again and again. And I think what becomes something to write about, the best advice I ever got in my life as a writer was from Mary Gordon, who was one of my first writing teachers in a writing class at Amherst College, right after Final Payments, her first novel came out. And she told the class, write about what's important. And that was kind of shocking to me to think about, because we were in an era at the time in which there was something going on that I and my friends kind of jokingly called Brady Bunch fiction, where you could refer to pop culture, and that made it sort of ironic, and everybody would know what you meant. But I rejected that, and I thought about what's important to me, and what's important, and how you know what's important is what keeps coming up again and again. So you see patterns in yourself. And I think that I don't think about the relationship except to imagine that it's going to be similar to the one that I have. I'm hopeful, like that all your friends will, like when you introduce your boyfriend to your friends, they'll all like each other. And you put him on the phone and, you know, and you get that feeling. It's like that in some funny way, but only later. In the beginning, it's just me and them. It's very intimate. It's in that dermatologist room where you'd die if anyone else saw you. I think that it's very... I don't think about them. How about you? What kind of...
Well, I do think about the reader a lot. Not at first when I'm... You know, I sort of think of myself as having to, like, make the clay that I... You know, you have to produce it. I can't go and buy it. So I have to spend a great deal of time sort of producing the clay to make the form and all that kind of stuff. And at that point, that's what I'm doing. But then as the work becomes something that is, you know, going to convey itself to another person, then I have to think in terms of, well, who is that other person? And I sort of have an ideal reader that, you know, is patient but not really patient and, you know, thoughtful but not, you know, anything super, sort of, somebody, but that's somebody who will instinctively understand after a few times that I'm lying to them and put it down. So I owe them a lot. I have a great sense of owing the reader some kind of truthful experience because they've opened the book and they've become like children in a certain way, trusting, and so I'm aware of that responsibility. So whether or not they like the characters, I don't care. You know, if somebody says to me, well, I hate Olive Kittredge, that's okay. I mean, why wouldn't you? If you were a certain kind of person, if you were another kind of person, you wouldn't hate her. So it doesn't, I don't care what they feel about. I don't care what their opinion is right. about the characters, but I want them to have a relationship with the characters.
Well, there has been a kind of a moralistic trend in reading in this country in the past few years where if you don't like the characters, that means you don't like the book. And I've heard that said, and it's very disturbing, actually, as a writer.
It's pretty limiting.
Well, I saw it for the first time when I taught the Tilly Olson story, I Stand Here Ironing, and people said I hated it because she was a bad mother. And I was disturbed by this, because what are we doing but showing what's real? You know, yeah. I mean, I think that when you know you're onto something in a story is when you're going where the heat is, but the heat may not be warmth. You know, it may be have a different quality to it. But that certainly would be the case with Olive, right?
And it's certainly one of the reasons that I go to fiction myself is to find out, like you said, you know, it wouldn't be my metaphor, the dermatologist, but I understand exactly what you mean. It's like you want to go inside, you know, where's that room that nobody else gets to go into? What's it like? Because we all live in one.
Right, yeah. I was thinking about dialogue and how it's so inextricable from character. And when you write dialogue, do you have your characters speak in real time, or do you try to convey as much as possible about them? I mean, I tend to go back again and again to the sort of bouillon cube metaphor for fiction, that it's a heightened experience. The day that one chooses to write about is not just any day, but a heightened day, and what do you think about that?
Well, I think, I mean, in terms of dialogue, anybody who's read a transcript understands that we don't speak very well, or in a way that most of us would want to read, and so I don't think that we can ever lose sight of the fact that writing is an artifice. This is, you know, we're faking it, you guys. We're making it, and we're faking it. You know, we're creating something to sound real. And it's not going to just automatically be transcribed from real life. So it's our job to choose the pieces of dialogue that will reveal that character most astutely, along with, you know, a gesture or whatever. And that's one reason I rewrite so much, is because you know, I don't want it to look like a transcript.
Right. And I think so much is really about choices. I think that is like one of the primary things that makes a story or a novel good, the choices that a writer makes. Because how do you know what reveals character, right? I mean, it's so...
Well, everything reveals character. Everything. It's cool.
I know. But you still have to choose.
You have to choose the right one. I mean, that's what makes it so interesting and also so crazy-making, because... You know, as you read over, you realize, well, that's actually a false gesture. That's a false sound. That's a false anything. You know, that's not who that person. It's just not. It's a shortcut, or it's, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
So you have to have your ear constantly going to what with that particular character.
Right.
How do they sit? How do they? You know, I mean. And that's where I go back to that intuition, that sense of just intuitively understanding, well, I'm somehow going to know. And I'm going to know at least when I'm wrong. I won't quite ever know when I'm right, but at least I'll know when I'm wrong.
Learning actually what's good and what works is, I think, something that changes over time so much. Like, you can have a student story filled with really very mediocre writing, and there's one line, and you say to the student, you see the line? And they stare at it, and they pick another line. And you give them another chance, and they still don't get it. And this line is so beautiful. And then the more you do it, I think they see because it's a line that reveals, in a way, that reveals and opens itself, I think.
Well, I think every line has to matter. I don't think you can have, you know, that's why...
No, but I'm saying this is just the beginning.
But the business of writing means going back and making every line rise to that level, if not higher, every single line. And you know, if you're sneaking a little phrase in there, then you're hurting yourself. You're hurting your reader.
Yeah. It's those, yeah, if you can go back and find the paragraphs that will be nobody's favorite in the book.
Those or are phrases.
Yeah, or words. Those are the ones you should really pluck out. The ones that are what I sort of think of as kind of the stuff that gets a character across a room, that's not enough. Everything sort of does double service if it's working. It gets them across a room with feeling, with depth, and it's just sort of a good...
Yeah, everything has to matter, you know, which is why we get so hungry and tired at the end of the day, like anybody else who has a job, you know, it's like, because you're just, you know, every single thing is, it's like a high wire thing when you're really, really, you know, down to it. It's very exhausting, yeah. which is true with any job when you're trying to do your best at it.
I think there's this great line from an essay by Zadie Smith called Fail Better, and it's on the internet and you can find it, and she says, when I write, I'm trying to express my way of being in the world. And I think that's really, for me, that's very encompassing of character as well as other things, and maybe it is for you. Not being in the world, maybe you'd adjust that verb a little bit.
Well, I mean, this is where I come back to my fiction that I'm not writing about myself. You know, that's what I, you know, gets me through my workday. And I have always been frustrated by the fact that we'll never know what it feels like to be another person. That's what I can't get over. I can't accept that.
Yeah.
But it's the truth. And so what motivates me to work, to go into character, is just, I think, partly that sense of, I want to know what it feels like. I want to know what it feels like to be you, just for a few minutes. Because, you know, maybe it's different, maybe it's not, but it's got to be. I mean, your walls are different than mine, your clothes feel different. You know, what's it like? We don't know. So I get to go and pretend that I'm trying to find out what it feels like to be another person. It's not really a pretense. I really am trying to figure that out, but of course I can only do it by my own experience, so it's all...
I came to that as a child, my version of that, it's almost like a little opposite of that. I wanted to feel that I was the only one doing something, like expressing a certain way. So I remember once when I was a kid, I jumped up and down, slapped myself on the head, and said, la, 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 because I knew I was the only person on earth doing that at that moment. And I felt very... It was about the singularity of character.
But I wonder if you were.
I know. That bothers me now. That, like in China, there was this...
A lot of people.
I know. We thought we would read something really, really...
What's that?
No, with all these people, the chances. What are the chances? I know. And if I met that person, we would have been soulmates. Well, I can't go there. We're going to read really briefly and then maybe take some questions. That's okay? So
yeah. I'd love to have you make use of, you know, us in any way that we'd be helpful.
Yeah. I thought I would read a tiny thing... We were looking for passages that were in keeping with this character theme. And I was going to read just a very tiny bit from the opening of The Wife and then the opening of my new novel, The Uncoupling. Because The Wife, this is my, you'll hear a difference, this is my first person book, but it describes, but I'm describing her sensibility, her way of being in the world, and then a little bit of describing her husband, who is central to this book. The moment I decided to leave him, the moment I thought enough, we were 35,000 feet above the ocean, hurtling forward but giving the illusion of stillness and tranquility. Just like our marriage, I could have said, but why ruin everything right now? Here we were in first-class splendor, tentatively separated from anxiety. There was no turbulence and the sky was bright, and somewhere among us, possibly, sat an air marshal in dull traveler's disguise, perhaps picking at a little dish of oily nuts or captivated by the zombie prose of the in-flight magazine. Drinks had already been served before takeoff, and we were both frankly bombed, our mouths half open, our heads tipped back. Women in uniform carried baskets up and down the aisles like a sexualized fleet of red riding hoods. Will you have some cookies, Mr. Castleman? A brunette asked him, leaning over with a pair of tongs, and as her breasts slid forward and then withdrew, I could see the ancient mechanism of arousal start to whir like a knife sharpener inside him, a sight I've witnessed thousands of times over all these decades. Mrs. Castleman, the woman asked me then in afterthought, but I declined. I didn't want her cookies or anything else. We were on our way to the end of the marriage, heading toward the moment when I would finally get to yank the two-pronged plug from its holes, to turn away from the husband I'd lived with year after year. We were on our way to Helsinki, Finland, a place no one ever thinks about unless they're listening to Sibelius or lying on the hot, wet slats of a sauna or eating a bowl of reindeer. Cookies had been distributed, drinks decanted, and all around me video screens had been arched and tilted. No one on this plane was fixated on death right now, the way we'd all been earlier when, trapped in the trauma of the roar and the fuel stink and the distant braying chorus of furies trapped inside the engines, an entire plane load of minds, economy, business class, and the chosen few, came together as one and urged this plane into the air like an audience willing a psychic's spoon to bend. So that's Joan's voice. And this is still Joan's voice, but really briefly, she describes her husband. He was Joseph Castleman, one of those men who own the world. All right. Consider that like a sorbet between courses. You know the type of man I mean, those advertisements for themselves, those sleepwalking giants roaming the earth and knocking over other men, women, furniture, villages. Why should they care? They own everything, the seas and mountains, the quivering volcanoes, the dainty, ruffling rivers. There are many varieties of this kind of man. Joe was the writer version, a short, wound-up, slack-bellied novelist who almost never slept, who loved to consume runny cheeses and whiskey and wine, all of which he used as a vessel to carry the pills that kept his blood lipids from congealing like yesterday's pan drippings, who was as entertaining as anyone I've ever known, who had derived as much of his style from the Dylan Thomas Handbook of Personal Hygiene and Etiquette. So that's a little bit about them. Do you want to read a little bit first? Or a little bit about them. Shall I finish up? Okay.
Why don't you, so we can fine. See the contrast of your first person.
So then, moving back into third person for my new novel, The Uncoupling, which is about, as I said, female desire over time, and it's about a metaphorical spell that falls on a town of women, causing them to turn away sexually from their men. But it opens with a couple, with the wife of a couple, who, unlike Joan and Joe Castleman, is part of a very, very happy marriage. They're younger. They're just around 40, and they're English teachers, and they love each other, and everything seems good at the beginning of the book. People like to warn you that by the time you reach the middle of your life, passion will begin to feel like a meal eaten long ago, which you remember with great tenderness. The bright points of silver, the butter in its oblong dish, the corpse of a chocolate cake, the leaning back in a chair at the end, slugged on the head and overcome. Dory Lang had always thought that there was a little cruelty in such a warning. It was similar to how, when she had a baby, people always tried to clue her in on what they were sure would befall her. Once long ago, Dory and her infant daughter were riding a bus in the city when an old woman leaned over and said, "May I tell you something, dear?" She had a kind face full of valleys and faults. Dory imagined she was about to describe the baby's beauty, in particular the curve of the mouth, and she made her own mouth assume a knowing, pleased modesty. But what the woman said, leaning even closer, was, "You will never have another day in your life that is free of anxiety." There was a little private pleasure to be taken in the fact that that old woman, though she was of course correct, was now dead and Dory was not. As for the warnings about the disappearance of passion, she recognized the sadism stitched into the words. Because the love lives of the women who said such things had gone soft and pulpy and tragic, they took a little comfort in telling as many women as they could that someday such a change would happen to them too. Dory and Robbie felt they were exempt from such an outcome, assuming when they were even so old that they appeared interchangeable, even when his ankles were as narrow and hairless as hers, and her lips were as thin and collagenless as his, and their pubic hair could have belonged to Santa Claus. Even when they resembled those dried apple dolls sold in the gift shops of folk museums, they would sleep together frequently, happily, and not just gently, but with the same gruff, fierce purpose as always. Around them in other houses in the neighborhood, there would be a terrible pileup of non-sex-having couples, all bone and tendon and indifference and regret, warmly, hotly, tirelessly, in their own bed, they would stay. So I'll stop there. Thanks. So.
Well, I hate to follow that with all, because they're so cozy. I'm just going to read two very, very brief scenes that I thought showed different aspects of Olive. As we said earlier, it's all third person, omniscient, really, with some sliding into, you know, closer and then pulling back. But the first is at the very beginning of the book when we first see Olive through, and it's mostly her husband's story. It's just actually not even quite a page, and I just wanted to explain a little bit about it. Olive had refused to go to church the day before, and Henry uncharacteristically had spoken to her sharply. And I'm actually going to stop myself, because I hate it when writers do that, and I always think I'll never do that, but I just did that, okay. Now, the reason I stopped is because when I realized I was choosing this, I looked and I thought, oh, look what I've done. I actually wrote uncharacteristically. Henry uncharacteristically spoke sharply to her. So I want to mention this since it's about character. First of all, I want to defend adverbs. I love them. I have always believed that a well-placed adverb is a beautiful thing. So I have no apology for that use of uncharacteristically. But the fact that I wrote it was interesting to me as I was reading over it, because it's just a way to let the reader know, because it's the beginning of the book. We've not seen Henry that much. It's a way of letting the reader know he doesn't usually do this. It doesn't mean it's out of character, because we can't write out of character. But it means that it's uncharacteristic of him to do, which we all understand. But anyway, so that's what I did. Olive had refused to go to church the day before, and Henry uncharacteristically had spoken to her sharply. Is it too much to ask, he had found himself saying as he stood in the kitchen in his undershorts, ironing his trousers, a man's wife accompanying him to church. Going without her seemed a public exposure of familial failure. Yes, she says. It is most certainly too goddamn much to ask. Olive had almost spit, her fury's door flung open. You have no idea how tired I am. Teaching all day, going to foolish meetings where the goddamn principal is a moron, shopping, cooking, ironing, laundry, doing Christopher's homework with him, and you! She had grabbed onto the back of a dining room chair, and her dark hair, still uncombed from its night's disarrangement, had fallen across her eyes. You, Mr. Head Deacon Claptrap Nice Guy, expect me to give up my Sunday mornings and go sit among the bunch of snotwats. Very suddenly, she had sat down in the chair. Well, I'm sick and tired of it, she'd said calmly, sick to death. A darkness had rumbled through him. His soul was suffering in tar. The next morning, Olive spoke to him conversationally. Jim's car smelled like upchuck last week. Hope he's cleaned it out. Jim O'Casey taught with Olive and for years took both Christopher and Olive to school. Hope so, said Henry. And in that way, their fight was done. So that shows not only Olive's character, but the character of their marriage. And that's how they finish a fight. Which is probably wise. The other little scene I was going to read is the story called Starving, where Olive has just, she's working for the Red Cross, she's collecting money, she's just gone into the house of Daisy, who's sitting there with Harmon and a girl who has anorexia, and she just walked in, knocked on the door and walked in, which is what people do in Maine, and they still do it, and I'm always so struck with that when I go back there. Just walk in. Anyway, so here she is, and she's come across this scene. And Harmon's point of view, if this is a male point of view, for better or worse. Olive was watching Nina, and Harmon followed her gaze. Nina sat motionless, slumped forward, the back of each rib bone defined against her thin t-shirt. She clutched his handkerchief with a hand that looked like the claw of a seagull. Her head looked too big to be supported by the ridged stick of her backbone. The vein running from her hairline across to her brow was a greenish-blue color. Olive finished the donut, wiped the sugar from her fingers, sat back and said, "You're starving." The girl didn't move, only said, duh. "I'm starving too," Olive said. The girl looked at her. "I am," Olive said. "Why do you think I eat every donut in sight?" "You're not starving," Nina said with disgust. "Sure I am. We all are." "Wow," Nina said quietly. "Heavy." Olive looked through her big black handbag, took a tissue, wiped at her mouth, her forehead. It took a moment for Harmon to realize she was agitated. When Daisy returned and said, "Here you go, Olive," slipping her an envelope, Olive only nodded, put it into her bag. "Jesus," said Nina. "Okay, I'm sorry." Olive Kittredge was crying. If there was anyone in town Harmon believed he would never see cry, Olive was that person. But there she sat, large and big-wristed, her mouth quivering, tears coming from her eyes. She shook her head slightly as though to indicate the girl needn't apologize. "Excuse me," she finally said, but she stayed where she was. "Olive, is there anything?" Daisy leaned forward. Olive shook her head again, blew her nose. She looked at Nina and said quietly, "I don't know who you are, but young lady, you're breaking my heart." I'm going to stop there, because I think that's a different side of Olive, who then goes and actually touches the girl after trying twice to get her hand down on the head, manages to get it there and makes contact. And so anyway, the point is that, you know, character is just an endless opening of things we're capable of and things that we feel that we're not capable of. And so at a certain time in a certain place, Olive's capable of whatever.
And it's not contradictory at all. It's just amplifying. Yeah.
But I will say that when I wrote that, I wasn't aware that Olive was going to be able to touch her head. So, you know, that's part of the fun of writing. That's a good day.
The surprises of it. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I think
that's such
great
a good
pleasure.
Day.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. So are there any questions? I don't know how much time we have.
When you said if there's an opening and various things happen, you didn't even know that she was going to touch her head, for instance. But we're taught, as writers, we're taught it has to be within the purview of the character. It can't be something, you can't put something in them that you haven't prepared us for. At least that's what I've always learned and thought was the right way to think of it, which can be very limiting too. In other words, we like when there's a surprise. We like when someone surprises us. But at the same time, you know, the thing about if there's a gun in the first act, it has to go off or something like that. I think it's related to that in that the character has to be of a whole. Not that they can't surprise you, but they can't be out of character. They have to be in character.
I would say that's where the intuition comes in. The question was, you know, how, you know, that we're taught to, you know, that the character, as many surprises as the character may deliver, it has to be in character. And so how do I know that Olive can touch this girl's head when I didn't know before that she'd be able to touch this girl's head? She hasn't, in previous stories, hasn't been able to, in fact, do that. And that's where the intuition comes in that I was talking about at the very beginning. For me, it's just an intuitive sense that I'm with Olive enough, I've worked enough with her, that I believe that action. And that's the writer's job. I mean, you know, Hemingway said, you know, all a writer needs is a really good bullshit detector. And I think of that so often.
Yeah.
It's really, that's it, folks. You know, it's like when you write something, you have to know, oh, that's false. And if you know that, that's great. But most of us keep thinking, oh, that's such a nice sentence.
Yeah.
Oh, I really like that sentence.
Oh, well, there's that Grace Paley line about the myth of the best love sentence, pluck it out. It's true, yeah. You know, kill your darlings, that whole idea, but it hurts because you're like, when you come up with a good sentence, you're the good student, but you have to be willing to not be a good student to be a good writer, you know?
Oh, you have to be willing to be a lot of things.
Yeah.
To be a writer.
Yeah.
But, you know, so that's where I would...
Yeah, back there.
When you're right, you have the end of the, you have realized that a lot of this is doing, and you're building on the character and the events that start with. But you have the end and the last episode in mind.
For the most part, I don't write from beginning to end, whether it's a short story or a novel. So I don't know what's going to happen at the end. Sometimes I have a sense of something and I'll write it down and it turns out it will be the end, either of a story or a novel. And if I haven't lost it by the time I get there, it may be the right one. But I don't know how it is with you.
I think I have a sense of it. It's like a very fuzzy mirage that looks like the cathedral. And the closer I get, it's a glove, you know? And then it becomes a cathedral again. I have to work towards something. I don't like writing into a void or feeling that I'm writing just freely into a kind of quilted diary. I never write out of order, unlike you. I kind of barrel forth, even when it's going badly. I'm a big believer in amassing pages, and because then at least, in my thinking, then you have something. And something is not nothing. And then you say, oh, this thing has taken on a shape. I didn't mean for it to take on this shape, but now I have to look at it. And kind of, it is what it is, and then you look at it. But so with that in mind, I do have a sense of an ending, but it is very, very malleable.
Well, I think place is very important. I think where we live and where we were raised and our relationship to the physical world is deeply important. I mean, that is part of character. It took me a long time to believe that or to even think it, but I do believe it and I do think it. So I'm interested in place and the intersection of character and place and time, you know, those three things. Will just sprout up who knows what. But the kind of writer I am, people are performing their daily lives in real place and time, and so that has to be acknowledged as honestly as possible. And if the character doesn't have a relationship with that place, that's part of the story. You can't just sort of say, well, I'm more interested in the character. That's not real. It's all, you know, it has to, even if the reader is not fully aware that that's what they're reading, that's part of the story.
Yeah, I think I would agree that place is central. I like the sort of interstices of it. I find it difficult when something is just, I find myself getting very ADD when it's just place, a long strip. The worst for me, yeah, we're all for adverbs, but I can't bear italics. In fact, the opening of a Passage to India, I always said was one of my favorite novels, and then I, you know, and it remains that because I believe it has so much to say about character, and so much to say about action and character together. But opening with the long description of the Malabar caves, I found myself searching and yearning for human comfort that I didn't find there. In a way that when I was younger, I was a different kind of reader. And I don't know if my brain has been changed by, you know, the internet and or what. But I like the places where character and place do join up. Do we have time for more? Are we okay? Is anybody?
Yes. So you're talking about character, and you talk about the character's relationship with the reader's relationship with your character. But what about the relationship between the character and the other characters? Because as a reader of your book, it seems to me that that is the essence of the development of the character.
Well, you're right. You're absolutely right, because that is what character is. I mean, we can all go sit in a room alone. Even with the dermatologist, there's a relationship.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, but if we sit in a room alone, you know, who cares what our character is? So character is always revealed in the bumping up against another character, whether, you know, whether it's somebody that you walk by on the sidewalk and don't see. That's still a revelation of character.
Everything in a novel is electric. That's how I feel. Don't you like these moments between people? They seem to have a kind of electricity about them, and that's how I know that that's revealing. Do you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean. I don't think of it as electricity, so I'm trying to think what I think of it as. Real. You know, it's like if I read and I think, oh, that sounds real. But you can fool yourself thinking.
Oh, you can trick yourself for many drafts. That's the worst thing. You become so convinced, you become demented that something really works. And you can't see it, and you can't see it, and it's that last time. And I don't know what it is about that extra time, but you are appalled at what you almost did.
Yeah.
Can you expand on that? Because you touched upon rewriting. Can you tell us something about your processes when it comes to rewriting?
The computer, everything changed. When I began writing, I sold my first novel when I was a senior in college at Brown in 1981, and I wrote on a Smith Corona. The thing quivered like an animal, you know? And I worked on it, and I did the kind of almost detail work with whiteout, and it was a craft. It was like scrimshaw, the whole experience. And rewriting was very thought, was very conscious. I think that there's something of an unconscious nature that the computer has given us, because I wish we could look back and see all the changes and the transformations that we've made over the course of a day. I think it would be shocking how many times we rewrite and go over it again and again. What I like to do, just quickly, is I like to work on it on the computer, get the best version, say, of a 3 pages that I've done and feel excited about. I print them out. I go sit somewhere new, like a coffee shop. I'm a big believer in sort of working in ambient noise, because you live in the city, you sort of need it. And I take a pen to it. And it almost feels like bravely defiling it, like doing, you know, graffiti to it. But I'm in charge. It belongs to me. It reminds me that it's mine. And when I take a pen to it, I can make some really big changes. And I enjoy that. And then I go back and input it, and it goes back all over again. So. Many, many times. Many. Dozens, really.
Well, I write by hand, so I'm not as affected by the computer. I do eventually type it into the computer and print it out, but I try and put that off as long as I can, because I like it to be messy and malleable. And I rewrite. I can't even tell you how many times I rewrite. It wouldn't be honest, whatever I said. Because it's just so many times that it's kind of
it's sickening.
It's sickening.
It's painful.
Yeah, it is. It's just nonstop.
Well, Beneath the Surface is the only thing that interests me, and everything, you know, always has, and as I said, I've never gotten over that to a certain extent. So, is it true that it took me 10 years? There are stories in it that took me 10 years. I'm a very, very slow writer. There are also stories in there that didn't take me 10 years, which seems to be quite fast. There are stories, you know, there are some stories that I wrote in less than a year, which I think that's true. Not many, but I think I wrote Starving in less than a year, which is amazing to me. Because I don't, you know, it takes me forever. So it's not false, but it's not completely true. And it just takes me forever. I wish so much it didn't, but it does. And each time it feels like it won't get done.
And how do you resist the urge to make the art bigger? Because I think that the subtlety is so powerful.
How do I resist the urge?
How is that nurturing?
It's not. There are many urges. Most of them would be to leave the room. That's the hardest part. It's like to stay there.
There's a line from John McPhee that he would have to tie the back of his bathrobe belt to the chair to stay seated. I think that sounds good. I think apparently we have time for one more question.
I was wondering if either of you, in the course of writing, as a check to, or as part of your editing or revising process, reads your work out loud
boy, I sometimes, I, usually when I like it and, I'm, and nobody is home, I'll kind of jump around the room and read a little bit, and it's like I get excited and I want to hear it. I wish I were freer with that. I still wish I were freer. I still feel dreadfully shy when it comes to that. When I'm giving a reading, I do sort of read it aloud, and then I hear it, and then I sometimes want to make changes if it's still something that I'm working on, and that's the moment that I actually still can. But generally, no. I think that there is a very loud voice of reading it in my head when I'm writing. When the work is going well, there's a kind of clamor, and it's almost like a version of my voice. So it's not so much when I'm writing. How about you, Liz?
Well, you know, I do read it out loud for a different reason than when I used to. But I read it out loud because I have, you know, reading out loud is hard. Anybody who's had kids, you get, you're like, oh, man, you know, they notice I skipped four pages.
There's also
it's just physically hard. And so when I read out loud, I do it to find out when I get tired. Because I can read it well. At this point, I know how to read my work to make to fool myself completely and make it think, you know, make myself think, oh, it's just great.
Yeah,
so I'm not reading it. You know, I used to read it to hear the false sentence. Now I can talk myself through a false sentence. So I'm reading it because I realize that I'll get tired when it gets phony.
Yeah, you could trick yourself with the lyricism. I go to Food Emporium, you know, using that poet's voice. So that they developed, that they all decided to use.
But then you're exhausted.
Then you're exhausted.
Forget Food Emporium.
Yeah, right. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah,
I guess that's about it.